So there'll be two applications, the AE10 data store and the AE11 chat will be what we'll talk about today. As always, this is copyright Creative Commons. And data is a big deal at Google. The first problem that they solved was they basically made an entire copy of the content of the World Wide Web in their servers. And then they try to make it so we can search it in a tenth of a second. And so that's a lot of data. It's a lot of disks, a lot of computers, a lot of spinning. And it's kind of the reason they built their entire cloud architecture was to create effectively one single database, which was the data of the web. They have not only the data of the web now, they have historical data. They like to watch how your pages change. For example, if you're a blogger, they want to see if you're like writing new stuff all the time. And if you're not writing new stuff, they don't watch you. So, you know, not only do they have the pages that they show you in search, but they have a long historical record of those pages as well. And it's the kind of thing where Google really had to completely invent a new way of storing and retrieving data. There was no database in the world. The most expensive database in the world was not capable of storing the kinds of data that Google needed to store and retrieving it at the speed at which Google needed to store it. So if you take like all of the student data of all the students that have ever attended University of Michigan since 1817, when we first had databases, they're a drop in the bucket compared to what Google has to. So they invented database technology, and we are taking advantage of that database technology. Now, one of the interesting things is that in a way, as I've gone to the Google conferences talking about their database, their own understanding of how to solve general purpose problems is still evolving. And there's this annual conference that's really cool called Google I.O. And I recommend, if you have a chance, it's usually in May in San Francisco. I recommend if you have a chance to go to one of them. It's an example of a developers conference. And most developers conferences, including the Google Developers Conference, the normal registration cost for a developers conference is usually about $3,000, and they have lots of candy and ice cream and soda, and they feed you and give you caffeine, and it's supposed to be sort of this really sort of nerd festival. But historically, last couple of years at least, since it started, Google gives a $50 registration to students and to faculty of universities. So you can go to this $3,000 conference for $50. In the first year, I got all excited, so I registered. And it sells out fast, and you gotta get in early. And the first year I went, basically, I had a former student who was living in San Francisco, and I had a frequent flyer ticket, and I took the bus from his house to the Moscone Center, and I paid $50, and so it was your basic crash on a buddy's couch in San Francisco and go for, you know, $50 plus 3 days of food plus a frequent flyer ticket. So I felt really efficient in that particular travel. So I recommend it, but they also do a great job of recording all of their sessions. And so this just happens to be one. It's not going to be on the exam. I'll give you a very simple, and everything will seem elegant, but it's good to hear sort of some of the creators of this software talk about its complexity. It's very interesting stuff, but not. We'll pretend everything's easy and perfect, and they'll talk about how when you push things to the boundary, you know, how things fall apart. Okay, so we introduced just a while back the notion of this model, view, controller design pattern. And the request response cycle is the sort of the engine that drives all this between the browser and the web server. Browser makes requests, web server does some magical thing, and then gives us a response. And so the model, view, controller is not really about the request response cycle. The model, view, controller is really what we do inside the server. It really is. There are many ways to produce the output, and we've actually done at least two. We had print statements in our very first web app, and then our second web app, we make this class that extends a request handler and has get methods and post methods. These are patterns. The notion of even using a template, that's a pattern. A pattern is something you don't have to do a particular way. You may have choices, but once we all sort of collectively decide something groovy, we call it a pattern, and then we tend to pretend it's a rule at that point. We just follow the pattern, mostly because it just makes it so each day we can get up and not have to rederive the truth from scratch. But it also captures good practice so that someone has thought this through and has ended up with good practice. So the kinds of problems that we have to do on every request response cycle, like a post request, is we got to take the form input, maybe we put it in a database for safekeeping. We have to decide which screen that we're going to send back to the user, because sometimes you send the same screen back, sometimes you switch screens, we've done these kinds of things. We retrieve any needed data from the database. Sometimes the data we want to show them is not exactly the data we had to store. Sometimes it's a little more or it's a different data. Then we produce an HTML response and then we send it back. And so you can kind of think of this as four distinct steps that we like to keep pretty separate in our thinking. And so the first is to handle the input, store the data, retrieve the data, build some HTML, and then send the response. And we often think of the data as being stored in like a different place, like in some database server that's off on its own, separation of concerns. And it has to do with the fact that the performance of these data servers, the ways that we make them fast, is often kind of very different than the ways we make our application servers fast. And so we can think of this as storing the data as sending it to another server that's kind of like even deeper in the background. The server that's talking to your request response cycles is sort of one set of servers, and then the ones behind it are the database servers. So in the model view controller terminology, the data bit, that sort of top layer, is the model. The model is the permanent storage for our application. The making of the next HTML, the templates that you've been doing, that's the view. We try to keep all these things separate. And then the orchestration of it all is the controller. And so in our application, the controller is our Python code, our index.py. And you'll notice we've gone now to great lengths to not have HTML in our index.py. It's all in templates. I'm going to guess when you first saw that, you know, and you were saying, some of you were looking at the print thing and says, well, the print's so easy. It's so beautiful. It's so elegant. But now that you've got a base template and you're schlepping stuff around and you're doing all this, you're quite comfortable with it. And you say, well, I'm kind of glad it's been, all that HTML is down in that templates folder and it's not schlepped all throughout my Python, because my index.py file is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's going to keep getting bigger and bigger. And if you were schlepping all your HTML inside that index.py file, not so good. So the controller is the Python code. It's kind of the brains of the operation. It receives the request and it produces the response, but it orchestrates everything else. It makes the decisions, what screen to show, whether or not to change the data. The view is your templates and generally your static stuff. And then the model is what we keep in the store. And so the definition is, here's a Wikipedia definition. And so the way I kind of draw this is there are all kinds of model view architectures. Like there's Java ones, there's Ruby on Rails is another one. The one we're using, this App Engine one, it really emphasizes the central role of the controller. Some others sort of like make it seem as though the view does work by itself, but In our code, the controller is our index.py file, and it's going to do all of the talking to the data, both the reading, the writing and the reading of the data, and it's going to pick the view that it's going to show, and then it is going to cause the view to be produced, and then it's going to take that string back from render, and then it's going to send that to the final output. So the controller is in the decisions of all the things. Everything is in the controller. In a way, this is one of the things I like about the Google App Engine that really lets the controller truly be in charge. So the controller is like this orchestration. It really kind of controls everything. So now we're going to add some models to our application. If you like this pattern of programming, it was actually adopted from a software project, an open source content management system called Django. Here at the School of Information, we're crazy about Drupal. Many of you are probably in the Drupal classes or going to end up in the Drupal classes, and then you will learn the Drupal religion. All these things kind of are religions in their own way. Django is a competitor to Drupal. It is a kind of Python version of Drupal. I don't want to get any debates as to which one's better. I think the market uses Drupal a lot, and we use Drupal a lot, and so it's a fine choice. But the models in Google App Engine are completely ripped off, as it were, from Django. As a matter of fact, the code's partially even ripped off from Django. And so this is the pattern. So if you're wondering where this pattern comes from, or if you wanted to use this pattern outside of Google App Engine, you'd have to go get the Django software. Again, Django is very like Drupal in terms of its ability. Google has this thing called Bigtable, and it's Google's database technology. You can read up on Bigtable. It's sort of amazingly simple, but yet amazingly powerful. We don't know all the details of how they do it, but they have written some white papers. So at some point, we've got to augment our index.py to make it so that we can talk to our database. And we do this, like all good Python things, by starting with an import statement. So you've got a bunch of import statements at the beginning of your code. We get one more. When we're going to start doing database things, we import this particular thing from Google App Engine EXT, import DB. And then early in our program, sort of starting in the left margin, so we're going to make another class. We've already been making class. Each of your handlers is a class. And when classes work, this bit in the parentheses, so if you look at your class main handler, it extends like web app request handler or something like that. This thing in the parentheses, when you have a class, is a bunch of code that's already written that you are extending. You're like inheriting everything about DB model, and then you're extending it with your own thing. So that's what this, when we say class, and then we put this thing in parentheses, that is like code that you're importing to make your own, and then adding to it. So you're making a new class called user that's extending an existing class called DB model. That would be from chapter 5. So then what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to make this new object, this new class called user. I'm going to extend DB model, and I am going to put three fields into it. I want an account field, a password field, and a name field. So we're in effect building a contract with the database. We're saying, hey database, when we talk to you, we are going to hand you these user objects, and we're going to take user objects back from you. And each user object, our contract with you is the user object is going to have account, password, and name. So this is like our contract. And then in the Python code, we use a constructor. We construct a new user object. That's what this user parenthesis is saying. Construct a new user object, and then a series of keyword value pairs that say, make the name of this user, make me a new user object. set its name value to Chuck, set its account value to CSEV, set its password value to PW. And that creates an object, and this object is sitting in our memory, but it's not stored in the database, until we tell the database system to store it using the put. So we're saying, make me a user, put some data in it. That's the first statement. And then put says, send that to the database and find a place to store it and keep that forever. So just sort of for example, so here's my little application. Okay, so then what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop my application. So if I hit refresh, it's going to say whatever it says. And I'm going to start my application again. Oh, then that would make this very boring. Boop. Whoop. There we go. Okay, not such a blank screen. Okay, so now let me go back to, here we are, happy little application. CSEV XYZ, log in. Okay, so here we are. I'll log out, log in. CSEV XYZ. Okay. So now I am going to stop my application. So my application is gone, okay, dead. And now I'm going to start it back up. And then I'm going to hit refresh, and it's back. And I'm going to log in. And all that data was there. My application was dead. Up till now, you kind of have data that just lives in the memory, like in your index.py. But when you do this put, it's stored like in a permanent, far-off, secret location. And so when we start it back up, it just reloads it. And you can actually see this if you look at the logs. If you look at the logs, somewhere up here, I think oh wait, it's probably farther up. Or maybe it just has stopped. Maybe it's just stopped telling me that it can't find the... Okay. It stores that in a file. So the point being is this put is a really important thing. It's what makes it permanent. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Yes?
On what you were just doing with the database, a few minutes ago when you showed us the other version, you had the Sally entry in there as well.
Yeah.
Where did she go?
She's in Illinois. She was in Tucson. If you remember, I did this. I clicked here and I clicked delete, and that's what happened to Sally. And it's permanent, right? I mean, Sally was permanently gone, and so she was long gone. I just never showed you that afterwards. So.
And then the second thing, could you explain the when you're starting in the Python code, the new class for the users, and you have to pass it a name. What is that syntax with db.thing property? What is that?
Okay, I'll kind of get to that. So, but okay, let me give you the sort of the short version of this. So, it's kind of a weird syntax. It looks like kind of an assignment statement, and it feels like a weird syntax. It feels like a weird syntax to me because it looks so much like an assignment statement. And of those of you who are familiar with databases, it looks quite unlike a create table. This is basically saying the name of the object, the name of the data field in the database. this is the name, account is the name of the data field, and this is the kind of thing it is. And they just have defined it as the syntax of an assignment statement. I'm sure deeply it has some deep meaning, but that's just all it's really doing is make me a field called account and make that a string. And so these are all strings. So that's what this little bit here is.
So it's just initializing that field?
It is, no, it's establishing the contract. The contract is I will be putting strings in here.
Okay.
There's many of these property types. String is only one of them. Do you want to change the lights?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. I mean, we can change the lights. It's after 9 o'clock. I can probably handle bright lights. So there's a number of property types, and string is only one of them. Integer, date, time, blob. Blob's like a big file, like if you're going to upload images and stuff like that and put them in your database. And then something we'll talk about in the second half of the lecture is what's called a reference property, which allows you to point one stored object at another stored object. And, you know, that's just the beginning. You can go look in the Google documentation and find property after property after property. But for now, we won't do many things other than keep it simple and store strings. Okay? And so that's the code that we've got to do. That's the code that we've got to add. And so the sequence of operations that trigger this is we're going to add this new account button. Then that'll go to a screen, and we're going to prompt for a name, account, and password. And then the post of this is going to actually do the adding of the data and also log us in. So we have this is the login screen. This is the apply screen. Okay? Now, I won't go through all the details in front of you. I'll bring the code up in a bit. But, I mean, I hope you're getting to the point where you can, like, add a new route and put a new handler in. And that is no longer, hopefully, you know, traumatic for you. And so imagine that I've got a slash apply that I route to a new thing called the apply handler. Okay, so I still have a login handler. I still have all these other things. I have an apply handler now that is going to receive the form post. Now there's also going to be a get in here. So on screen, I have to take all this stuff down to a much more minimal kind of thing. So the get's not there. The get would have like a little line that's just rendered the form. The post is receiving the form. So I keep taking stuff out because I hope by now that's more natural to you, or at least more natural to the person who's helping you write your homework. So if you look, it's kind of like the post on the login handler from the previous assignment. We've got a form with three values on it. We establish a session. We just do that at the beginning because we may or may not be logged in at this point. Then we are going to grab the name, account, and password. And then we're going to ask the database if this account has already been created. So we want to put up a nasty account if the account's already created. And so we do a query. db.query. If you remember, db is the thing that you imported. So this db variable, that's the import. db.query. Query is a method. I would like to make a DB query for user objects. That's what this user is. This is a kind of database object. It's a user object that we put in the database. And I would like to filter that query based on the account field in the database and whatever this string X account is that came in off the screen. So what that's doing is that's making sure that I can't log in I can't make a new account called CSEV. Oops. It's going to tell me account already exists. Okay, so if I go back to the code now, right? So I've pulled in the account name, CSEV. It's in this variable X account, and I'm going to do a database query to check to see if something already exists with that name. I'm doing that before I create it. And then I do a query fetch, and I only want one, and results is a list of database objects. And so if there is more than one database object with an account named CSEV, if that's greater than zero, then I basically say I'm going to go back to my apply screen and send back an error variable. And I hope you guys kind of can imagine quickly in your mind with that apply screen. It's got a little if in the bottom, and it shows the error if the error is set. It's the same kind of stuff you've been doing now, right? And if that error happens, then I return and I'm done, and that's the code sequence that gets me out. After I'm done with my error checking, I'm going to put these two lines that basically say, create a new account, new user object in memory, set its name variable to the name from the form, set the account variable to the name from the account from the form, set the password from the form. That creates it in the memory. Now put says, store it in the database. So now at that moment, if that succeeds, you're in good shape. And then we are going to set, and this is from this assignment, set the session username to be the account so that we are indicating that this person is logged in. We're making login be a side effect of new account creation. On real systems, you do things like send people email, but now we'll just let you create an account and have you be logged in, and then we send you back to the index. So if this is the controller code. The controller code deals with the incoming data, chooses which screen to show. Sometimes it shows this screen, sometimes it shows this screen. Updates the data in the database, potentially retrieves some data, and then produces it. So this is the model view controller that I sort of started talking about at the very beginning. Any questions on this screen? Yeah?
Can you explain a little bit more about results?
Yes. Yes. So the querying of the database is a two-step process. First, you build a query, and then you run the query. So this first step here is building a query. We are making a query that knows how to query users, and then we're adding a filter to it that says only grab users that match this field. This is not actually talking to the database. This is preparing to talk to the database. Just like this is not talking to the database, it's preparing to talk to the database. This is talking to the database. It says run the query. So if this was a lot of data running in a big system, this would take maybe a tenth of a second or so to actually contact the database, have the database look through all of its stuff, and then glom those things all back up, and then hand you back the user objects that match the query. So what results is a Python list of user objects. So it's a Python list of user objects. That list could be empty if there are no user objects that match the filter, or there could be 50 of them if I put them in. Okay?
What is the limit equal?
What's that?
What's limit?
Limit equals one says, look, if there's 1,000 of them, only give me one of them. Because all I'm really doing is an existence check rather than I just want to see if there's at least one. And so that sort of gives the database permission to operate a little more quickly. That's what limit one is saying. Any other questions? Yeah. Well, this doesn't matter because, you know, apply handler, it's like a router that sends it to the right one. That's just kind of how you want to organize your code. So it doesn't have to be after in the index.py file because, you know, it's...
So you just plop it at the top?
You can plop it at the top, plop it at the bottom,
okay.
Wherever you feel like it. I mean, there's class, 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 and those are really very independent from each other. No, there's no order because in a sense if you go down to that bottom bit of code, Okay, so there's the, my index.py. So here is my import for the database. Here is my user model, which is my contract. By convention, we tend to put these at the beginning, just kind of to get them out, so that it's just convention. You'll notice that I put the model first, my sort of defs second, that are kind of global for the whole file. Then I've got my classes, right? The login handler, the apply handler, the members handler, the logout handler, and the main handler. Now the order of those doesn't matter, because really these are sort of absolute global routes that basically say, when I see slash logout, regardless of order, go to logout handler. When I see members, go to members handler. So those are just kind of like absolute references. And so the order of all those classes really doesn't matter. And the only time an order of a class would matter is if somehow I was defining a class that I was extending myself, then I'd have to do it first. But we're not doing that. We're extending webapp.requestHandler for each of these. But that's actually coming in from right there anyways, so the order doesn't matter. The order would matter if we had a lot of complex inheritance of classes that was our own structure, but not in this application. I just tend to put them in order that makes somehow sense to me. Sort of the order I wrote them, and then logouts near the end and main handler, I don't know. The order is just kind of how I wrote them. Any other questions? It's okay to ask questions. You'll be by yourself in 2.5 weeks when you're trying to write this. Okay. So, the high level of this, take the form data, the get method. So what's not shown on this slide is, see the get method for apply handler? It just throws a template up with the three form variables. I'm happy if you could understand that sentence with no further parsing. Apply template just throws up the form with three form variables and everybody gets it. This is where it'd be nice if I had one of those clicker things to find out really if everybody got it. You know, so I could say a one sentence expression that maybe none of you knew 2 weeks ago, but now I can just like just have those things roll off. That's half of it, so we can have a good, you have enough terminology so we can have a conversation. So the get method in the apply handler simply renders apply screen, which has that form in it. So I don't show that on the slide, because the post method is where all the excitement is. Okay? Okay, let's continue on. So I've already mentioned that you can use this thing called the developer console. It's quite awesome. It's got a URL, this __ah/admin. You can actually go to it by the URL, or you can go to it by clicking on the SDK console button in your launcher. And for now, the only thing we do interesting in it is play with the data store viewer. Although we'll play with the interactive console quite soon. Okay. So that tells us how we make the apply screen, fill out the apply screen, do error checking in the apply screen, enter data in the apply screen, and log the user in. Now we're going to write the screen that does the members list. And so this is a little different, because now we're reading a database, and we need to take the data from the database and put it in that screen. So if I look at the screen, it is now we're going to do this screen. Well, let me put Sally back in. So So the key is the key that's a little different, and we're going to see some new HTML and we're going to see a new technique in templates, is everything we've done in templates so far is just a variable that has a string in it. Now, in effect, we are going to figure out or show how to deal with lists. So we're going to have a list of users. We might have one, we might have two, we might have 500. So we need to handle all these folks. Okay? So this is how we do it. So we'll start with the controller code. And this is the controller code in the members handler. And we do the same kind of query that we did before, but you'll notice this one has no filter on it. So it doesn't have a filter. We say, let's make a, we're preparing ourselves to do some queries on users, and we want all of them. Now, this query, if you go look at the documentation, you can do sorting on it, you can do filtering on it, you can make these queries quite complex. For those of you familiar with SQL, say from SI502, this is not using SQL, this is its query syntax, like a select from SI502. This is Google App Engine's replacement to this. You can sort of debate whether you need to think each one's more elegant or natural, but this is how App Engine does it. It effectively uses its Python syntax to construct its queries. But again, the query never talks to the database. The query is this statement here is make me a query. Now when we call fetch is when it actually makes the connection to the database and retrieves it. So here we're saying I want a query for all users. And then I'm going to say fetch me the first 100. Now our poor little application doesn't have paging, so if we make more than 100 users, it's never going to show you more than 100. But we're not really writing a real application, so it's a toy application, so we'll be fine. So I'm just saying now make this connection, read the user objects, and bring them back to me, and then give me back a list of them. And then I'm going to call the member screen render, and I am going to pass, again, you know, sorry for the clever mnemonic use of the name, a variable name. This user list is this variable, and this user list is a string that's going to make sense in the template. Okay? So I just happen to name them the same. Don't get too worried. That's the actual list from Python, and that's the name we're going to call it in the template. So for my own sanity, I'm letting them be the same. Okay, so this is a Python list that we are passing into our template. Everything we've passed in so far here has been a string, but now we're passing a list, and it's a list of objects. Okay? Inside of our members.htm template, we have some new syntax. It's not that strange. It looks kind of like Python. So we have this little curly brace percent, and instead of, this is where we do if equals a lot. Now we're going to say for. So part of the template language is for user in user list. It really functions just like a Python for loop, where user is the iteration variable, user list is our list. The list can have zero or more things, just like in Python. If the list had zero things, the body of the loop would run zero times. The body loop will be run once for each element in that list, and the user variable will be populated by the successive elements in the list. And we're going to print out the user's name, user's account, and user PW. These things are the same as the variables we agreed with the database when we defined our model. And so that is the template language. I'll explain the HTML in a second. Any questions on the template language? So up till now, we've only had a variable, but now we're going to do a variable and a piece inside the variable. So user.name. That's the name thing inside the user object is all we're saying. And this is that iteration variable. That comes from the model definition. Those are the three things we agreed when we built the model that were going to be in that model. Okay? So now, let's talk about the HTML. So this is just HTML. let me show you what it looks like. It looks like this. See, we're making this. This is what's called a table in HTML. In the old days of HTML, we used tables for things that weren't tabular data. We used tables for layout. Tables for layout is like really tacky. But making tables for tabular data is seen as wonderfully elegant. So if you use a table in your HTML source code, you are either wonderfully elegant or horribly tacky, depending on if your intent was to represent tabular data, they love you, and if your intent was to use tables to deal with where div should be used, then they will laugh at you mercilessly. So, the table tag, start of a table. I should probably not even tell you about this because it's just so obvious. So table, end table. Each row in the table starts with tr and ends with slash tr. And each column within a table starts, a data column starts with td, ends with slash td. This row starts with tr and ends with slash tr. You can make a header line if you like by making a special row that has some ths in it. So there's three headers and then there's three columns. First column's the name, account, password. So if I was to look at the source of this, it looks like many other pages that came before it because it extends base.htm. It's got Groovy class equals selected capability. I assume you know how to do that, so I won't re-explain that. But the new bit is this table, right? And so my code must be a little different because it's got these, this row is not all one line, but it's still a row with three headers, a row with some data, and a row with some data. This part here is what's coming out through the loop. If there was one person, one user object, we would get one row. And if we did two user objects, we would get two rows. So tables, I've never had any trouble memorizing the table syntax because it's just table, tr, td, and th. And that's it. And then it renders like that. And then there is a whole bunch of CSS that renders this as well, but I can show you. I don't have slides for it, but I can show you the CSS that causes that table to work out so nicely. Oops! I closed my text wrangler. Let's fix that. So one of the things about about tables is that the CSS default for tables is extremely ugly. So you have to always style them. So I add some CSS. You guys might as well just, this is in the book, you might as well just take this directly, at least as your starting point to make your tables. If you have to, but you don't have to do tables, I don't think. Nope. Yeah. So if you do tables, you can just borrow this. It's all in the book. The default looks really, really ugly. And basically, what I'm just basically putting a little border around, changing the color a little bit, making the background gray, misspelling it for the headers and the table things and black. You know, it's all simple stuff. It's all simple CSS, and you don't have to put Don't bother putting classes or divs on any of this if you don't need it. Just style the table tag, the TH tag, and the TD tag. Let's see. Okay, so that's all I plan to cover on this AE10 data store. Any questions?